ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, communities in northwestern Australia brace for Cyclone Fina after it caused havoc in the Northern Territory. Also, the government's still struggling to get enough support for its new environmental protection laws. And a Tasmanian man takes to the seas in a boat made entirely out of marine junk.
I've been battling storms as I travel in the raft and learning how to sail this vessel safely and stopping at lots of places along the way.
First this evening, communities in northern parts of Western Australia are bracing for the arrival of Cyclone Fina. It passed through the Northern Territory on the weekend, causing extensive damage on the Tiwi Islands and knocking out power in both remote areas and Darwin. The cyclone has gone back out to sea and reached Category 4 status and is due to hit the coast of the Kimberley region in WA's far north sometime tonight. Diana Damjanovic reports.
It's the most powerful cyclone seen in the top end since Cyclone Tracy in 1974. Darwin was hit hard. 70 kilometres north of Darwin on the remote Tiwi Islands, the damage is worse. The community of Wurrumyunga has a population of 1,500. One of its residents is Heidi Dawn, acting CEO at the Tiwi Islands Regional Council.
So being a fairly low-lying coastal town, we definitely copped some really strong winds. We have trees on houses. We have trees still in power lines. Significant damage to some major infrastructure, you know, especially like our essential services. With the amount of trees that have fallen on power lines, the damage is going to start racking up for sure.
She had a close call while sheltering in her home on Wurrumyunga.
We had a tree fall on our house fairly early on in the cyclone, so probably when it first came through, it fell over my kids' bedroom. So we all were retreating in the kitchen when it came through just to keep together and keep safe. It was probably the safest place of our house. So it was quite scary. It was very windy, a lot of rain coming through.
Heidi Dawn says when the cyclone hit, authorities were moving up to 250 people into an evacuation centre at the local school. The building isn't cyclone coded, but it was dry.
We were still moving people in non-coded homes into the school during the cyclone, which wasn't ideal, but as the wind started to pick up, we had to start moving people that wanted to stay put, but then they had obviously got too much.
On Wurrumyunga, the full extent of the damage is still not clear. As of late this morning, no planes have been able to land on the Tiwi Islands due to poor visibility. That meant emergency workers to restore power and water, as well as fresh supplies, hadn't arrived. Power is out, roads are cut, and food is scarce. Heidi Dawn says she's not sure where the council will get the money for the repairs.
You know, a lot of these homes are overpopulated as it is. They all, you know, a lot of families do live together. So having food in stores is not, is fairly uncommon because they do, some houses honestly don't have their own fridge. So they do rely on the shop and things like that to open regularly to provide food for the family.
Meanwhile, NT Health CEO Chris Hosking says there was some good news as the cyclone made its way over Darwin.
We had five babies born in Royal Darwin over the period where Fina was impacting on Saturday. And one of those, all girls, five girls, and one of those little girls has been named Fina.
In Darwin, the clean-up effort is well and truly underway. Tree-strewn streets are a hub of activity as emergency crews work to restore power to thousands of homes. For this pair of electricians, the cyclone was one to remember.
Oh, I wouldn't say best memories, but I'd say some pretty good memories, yeah. Yeah, it was basically weekend on a back veranda, basically, yeah.
Nah, it was pretty sick, eh? Had a bit to do, got bogged a fair few times, but they're sick.
The next areas to be hit are in northern Western Australia. Cyclone Fina has moved out to sea and has intensified to a Category 4 system, with winds gusting up to 270 kilometres an hour. It's slowly moving southwest. Residents in parts of the Kimberley and northern WA have been told to expect damaging winds and heavy rain, with the core of the cyclone due to cross the coast tonight. The Department of Fire and Emergency Services WA is warning people between the Cambridge Gulf and north of the Berkeley River Lodge to shelter indoors now. Todd Pender is the Superintendent for the Department of Fire and Emergency Services in the Kimberley region.
Currently, the deepest priorities around TC Fina are around life and property and making sure our responders are also safe.
Kim Holm is the CEO of the Kalumburu Aboriginal Corporation in the Kimberley. She says her community is prepared.
You know, just tying a few things down, getting rid of some old debris and things that, you know, you collect over a period of time, and just making sure we've got our proper normal every year cyclone kits ready and waiting. So some water, some torches, bit of food that you don't need to cook just so you can wait out a storm.
Kim Holm is the CEO of the Kalumburu Aboriginal Corporation in the Kimberley in WA. Diana Damjanovic with that report. The federal government is demanding the Bureau of Meteorology explain why its new website has ended up costing $96 million rather than the initial estimate of $4 million. And the opposition certainly isn't happy about the cost blowout either. The Nationals leader, David Littleproud, is accusing the Bureau of misleading the public and suggesting it should face consequences. All this amid mounting criticism from the public that the website isn't user-friendly. Julia Bergen has more.
First, we were told it was $4.1 million, but now it's $96.5 million. The total cost of redesigning the Bureau of Meteorology's website has drawn plenty of criticism, and Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt is not happy.
I think the bomber's got some explaining to do.
News of the blown-out price tag came from the Bureau itself. The new chief executive wanted the organisation to come clean. Dr Stuart Minchin has been in the job for 2 weeks, and although Minister Watt says he deserves some time to unpack what went so wrong, he expects answers.
What the bomb had said to me was that there were other elements of the website design that did increase the costs. I don't think that I was aware of that total cost of $96 million. I certainly knew that it was more than four, and my recollection is that there were media reports at the time that said that the $4 million related to just the website design, but there was a lot of back-of-house activity that had costed more. But I understand that people are very concerned about that amount of money, and that's why I've asked the new CEO to get on top of what occurred.
In a written statement to the ABC, the Bureau says the original figure of $4 million is accurate, but it only applies to the front-facing part of its website, the part people see and use. The other costs are all behind the scenes, for work on coding, data inputs, testing. That came to almost $80 million. And costs for security and the launch added another $12.5 million. A spokesperson for the Bureau says the website is data-heavy and draws on all sorts of technical infrastructure to function.
A complete rebuild was necessary to ensure the website meets modern security, usability and accessibility requirements for the millions of Australians who rely on it each day.
Less than a month ago, when the Bureau launched its new site, there was outrage. People couldn't find things, they couldn't read things, and as destructive storms lashed large parts of the country, people weren't getting the information they needed. It prompted an intervention from the federal government and an apology from the Bureau's then-acting chief executive, Dr. Peter Stone.
The new website was designed to improve the long-term security, stability and resilience of critical Bureau services. I acknowledge that there have been concerns raised by the community about the new website, and I recognise how significant these changes can be.
Certain parts of the website were scrapped, and then came news about the true cost. Web designer Dave Eddy, who had nothing to do with this project, says the $96 million price tag is a shock, but website redesign costs can vary. As managing director of web design company Redback, he says that ranges from a few thousand dollars to hundreds of thousands.
Where the time and cost really comes in is doing things that are custom or outside of the box, custom code, custom design, out of the box sort of animations. Integrations is a big one. That's a common thing. A lot of businesses have a need to make their website talk to their other systems, their inventory systems, their CRM.
Dave Eddy says for an organisation like the Bureau of Meteorology, with so much data, graphics, visuals and users, it's not hard to imagine the costs piling up.
They would have went through a fairly or very intensive user research process or step to really understand what all the different types of users, like the fishermen, the general sort of mum and dads wanting to check the weather, all the other different people that use the site, and really understood firstly what they're using the existing site and app for, and then where can that be improved and things like that before they even get to design.
Dave Eddy is a web designer. That report from Julia Bergen. In Canberra, the Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt is pushing desperately to get support for the government's new environmental laws so they can be passed in Parliament's last sitting week of the year. But so far, he's failed to win over either the Coalition or the Greens. The government says its bill will deliver on recommendations made in a 2020 independent review of environment laws and both protect the environment while giving business and industry greater certainty and a quicker assessment process. Tanya Dendrinos filed this report.
Time is running out as the government tries to push through its Environment Protection Reform Bill. It'll go before the Senate on Wednesday, and this is the final sitting week of the year.
I'm in under no doubt that we will pass these laws this week.
That's Murray Watt, the Minister for the Environment and Water. He's confident, but in order to pass the legislation, Labor needs the backing of either the Greens or the Coalition, and significant sticking points remain. Nick McKim is the Greens forestry spokesperson.
We're after an agreement with Labor that the laws will actually deliver for native forests, that the laws will actually deliver for climate, and that the laws won't take us back. And I'm sorry to say that the package that Environment Minister Murray Watt has put on the table are actually, at the moment, a step backwards.
The Greens want an end to native forest logging.
It's an industry on life support. It's an industry that in Tasmania alone sucks tens of millions of dollars a year out of the health system and out of the education system in public subsidies. And it's an industry that's tremendously damaging to the environment, to threatened species and to the climate. So yes, we need to see an end to native forest logging. We of course need to support logging communities through a transition, and that is what responsible governments would do.
Matthew Terenius is the spokesperson for the Tasmanian Sawmillers Association.
Forestry is being used as a pawn in the game, and Tasmanian workers will suffer.
Minister Watt says he's willing to make further compromises, but the package must be balanced and deliver for both business and the environment.
We have said, and I've said privately to the Greens, that we're not going to be ending native forestry altogether, and we're not going to be getting rid of regional forest agreements under which native forestry occurs, but we are open to increasing the environmental standards expected of native forestry, and that's one of the things that Graham Samuel recommended. So I have made that offer both to the Greens and the Coalition.
Independent Senator David Pocock is calling for 15 changes and says hurrying through the legislation is the wrong approach.
The exemption from our environmental laws for native forest logging, that clearly has to change. There's exemptions for land clearing. Those things have to change. You actually have to have an independent EPA that is actually independent. It can't just be independent by name. You know, I think there's a range of things that if we are serious, you know, we are the world leaders in extinction. We have ecosystems in this country that are on the brink of collapse. And so as a parliament, we have to get this right.
The Coalition has issued a list of 7 substantive issues it wants addressed in the bill, including watering down the powers of the new Environmental Protection Agency and making its CEO accountable to the minister. The Shadow Minister for the Environment is Angie Bell.
We are 100% focused on EPBC reform, but we are not in a rush to fail on this. We want to deliver a constructive way forward with the government to get good outcomes for jobs, industry, productivity, investment, and of course the environment.
She says the ball is in the minister's court. Murray Watt says it's not clear which party he'll do a deal with yet, but that the Greens and the Coalition have a decision to make.
Do they want to be part of passing historic reforms to our national environmental laws, or do they want to see the other side get in on the action and do it with us instead?
The package is made up of 1,500 pages of legislation and has been referred by the Senate to the Environment and Communications Legislation Committee for inquiry. Its report isn't due until March.
Tanya Dendrinos. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Officials from the United States and Ukraine have released a statement saying good progress has been made on thrashing out a peace deal to end Russia's war in Ukraine. The talks were held in Switzerland overnight our time. The 28-point plan pushed by Donald Trump has been condemned by Ukrainians as giving in to Russia. It includes proposals for Ukraine to give up territory, restricting the size of its military, and ruling out NATO membership for the besieged country. The US now says intensive negotiations will continue over the next few days. The Australian Federation of Ukrainian Organisations has strongly rejected the proposed peace plan. Katerina Argeru is the organisation's chair.
It's straight out of the Kremlin playbook. It's a shameful deal, not a peace plan. And the way that we see it, it's a dangerous capitulation to tyranny and aggression.
Which of its provisions do you object to in particular?
The biggest things that really jump out at us as a Ukrainian community here in Australia is that this so-called peace plan is proposing for Ukraine to give up land and to give up land that it currently controls. This peace plan is not calling for the aggressor, the occupying forces, to leave the land of a sovereign nation. It's actually calling for Ukraine to give up more land. And for us, it's very worrying because over the past 2 years, the Russian Federation has only been able to occupy an additional 1% of Ukrainian territory. And we have what is supposed to be one of our biggest allies, the United States, and President Trump, that's supposed to be the leader of the free world, saying, okay, Ukraine, basically give up some more land. And for us, it's not just land behind the line in the sand that divides a free Ukraine and the occupied part of Ukraine. Behind that line in the sand is daily war crimes that are being committed. So obviously that is the most concerning part for us. And also things like calling for Ukraine to agree to never joining NATO. That is a decision that only the Ukrainian people can make.
What's the feeling amongst the broad Ukrainian community in Australia and the people you speak to back home? Would they be prepared to accept Ukraine giving up any land to achieve peace and stop the killing?
I have to say that there's no one that wants peace more than Ukraine. There are no other people that want peace more than Ukrainians in our Ukrainian community here in Australia. But it has to be just peace. What really concerns our Ukrainian community here in Australia is the dangerous precedent that this would set. If anything is agreed in terms of land grabs or land being handed over under the guise of this supposed peace that Russia would then offer, it would also set a very dangerous precedent for the global community. It would set a precedent that borders of sovereign and independent nations can be changed by force.
Talks were held in Switzerland overnight, and the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says progress was made. One of the points they're working on is that there must be an assurance that the sovereignty of Ukraine is upheld. Not a lot of detail is coming out about where progress has been made, but are you seeing any changes as yet in those negotiations that would make the deal or the plan more palatable for Ukrainian Australians?
Well, the only thing that would be palatable for Ukrainian Australians is that the occupying forces would leave the territory of Ukraine. We have to keep in mind that whatever is agreed, Ukraine must have security assurances, but Ukraine must also have a just peace. And it cannot start with any discussions of giving away territory and subjecting people to torture and war crimes behind lines of occupied territories.
Katerina, how important is it for the Ukrainian people to honour all of those Ukrainians who have died already in the fight, while balancing that with the hope that the killing can stop and more Ukrainians won't be sent to their deaths?
We honour our fallen soldiers and our fallen heroes every single day. Ukraine, which I visit often, starts every single day with a minute of silence. And you can hear it on all the public systems where there's a countdown of a minute of silence honoring those who have fallen for a free and independent Ukraine. So there is that daily reminder on the territory of Ukraine. For us and our community here, there's a daily reminder of the price of freedom, and it's the highest price that Ukrainians are paying now. And we have many community members, including my own family, that has been impacted by Russia's brutal invasion.
Katerina, what's happened in your family that motivates you so much?
I had six of my family members that were on the front line. I currently have one left. My cousin was killed a couple of months ago on the front line. My family has paid the highest toll. My mom was just injured because of a missile strike that hit the building right next to her. That was just tens of meters away from her. All her windows were shattered. Her bedroom door was blown out. She had brain injury and is in hospital on a weekly basis now, recovering and getting treatment. I can just go on and on, and I'm just one story of millions.
Katerina Argeru chairs the Australian Federation of Ukrainian Organisations. To raise awareness of Australia's polluted seas and waterways, an avid sailor has made his way across treacherous Bass Strait on a raft made solely out of marine waste. It took Samuel McLennan years to build the boat using rubbish he collected from oceans, rivers and creeks in Tassie. The 48-year-old now has plans to sail along Australia's east coast to promote the need to keep our oceans clean. Kathleen O'Connor filed this report.
After weeks at sea, Tasmanian man Samuel McLennan arrived in St Kilda in Melbourne on a raft made entirely of marine waste.
Hey, 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 Melbourne! Here
you come. I've been battling storms as I travel, learning how to sail this vessel safely, stopping at lots of places along the way.
Mr. McLennan spent the last few years collecting debris from the ocean, beaches and other popular waterways around Tasmania that he decided to put to use. He used the junk to build the boat and then sail it across the notorious Bass Strait to raise awareness of pollution.
I thought it was only going to take 3 months, but it ended up taking 2 years. And the materials that I found were a lot of commercial aquaculture industry rubbish, which had been washing up on Tasmania's shores. Lots of it was actually fish farm waste, pipes and oyster farm and mussel farm stuff. Most of this material has been built for the marine environments.
Samuel McLennan says he was shocked at the volume of waste he was collecting. He left Tasmania in April last year and is aiming to get to Sydney in the next 12 months. Along the way, he will be volunteering with local environment cleanup groups, hosting talks at schools and other organisations about the importance of keeping Australia's waterways clean.
Teaching people how to change from being a victim and waiting for someone else to take action, to taking responsibility and being empowered to take action, to really change the direction that we're heading as a society and as a planet.
The issue of rubbish polluting our waterways and oceans continues to frustrate environmentalists. Kip Hamilton is plastics campaign manager at the Australian Marine Conservation Society.
Unfortunately, plastic pollution is still continuing to increase. In Australia, there's about 250 kilograms of plastic that's entering our environment every minute. Once there, it's almost impossible to recover. It's, you know, smothering our corals, starving our seabirds and entangling and kill turtles. It's absolutely devastating how easily rubbish has been able to be collected for this initiative.
Kip Hamilton says plastics are being ingested by sea life in Antarctica and we need an international approach to the problem.
The Global Plastics Treaty is currently in negotiation at the moment. It's a UN process to develop new global laws about how we're tackling plastic pollution. It's important that this treaty covers the full life cycle of plastics so that we're stopping the problem at the source.
She says it's not an issue that's going to go away overnight. Dr. Cherie Motti is a research scientist at the Australian Institute of Marine Science.
We have an Australia-wide monitoring program known as the Integrated Marine Observing System program, and we are searching for microplastics in waters in every state and territory around Australia. And what we're finding is plastics in every single sample.
That's Dr. Cherie Motti from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The devastating Optus outage that was linked to three deaths revealed we can't always trust we can get through when we call 000. More than 2 months later, surely the system has been fixed. Today, consumer affairs reporter Michael Atkin on why some people still can't get help when they need it most. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.